G'day, Groovers. Welcome to another instalment of The U Project. Tiffany Ann Cook over there at Tiffany Ann Cook Central. Hello.
Good morning. How are you?
Oh, look, I'm bursting out of my flannel. It's been a big morning. I was at the cafe at 0600 downing some caffeine to stimulate the old nervous system to get everything going. Then I did a coaching session with Charles, who's all over the shop, but I love him and he loves me. And now I just did it. You know how I never do any research on guests?
Yeah, I know.
I broke my own rule. And I got a little bit excited because I think our guest is good. I think she's really interesting. And also, you know, like when we're staring down the barrel of 500 episodes, and it dawned on me that we've never done an episode on parenting. Have we?
Oh, I've nailed it. I'm pumped then.
No, yeah, well done you. We've never done it. So, and we've never done, and because I've never grown up, I think this could be a good fit because I'm essentially a man child. So I think I could get some free advice. Hi, Vanessa.
Hello, hello.
Now, Dr. Vanessa Lapointe, I've heard a few people struggle to get their gob around, gob's an Australian word for mouth, to get their gob around your surname. How do you, well, I was going to say, how do you say it? What I should say is, how is it correctly pronounced?
Exactly as you said it. You win.
Well, also that is good for my self-esteem. So thank you. Thank you. So you are, for want of a better term, a kidologist, a parenting guru, a psychologist, a doctor. What did you do your PhD in?
In school psychology. So how the mind comes online and learns and the various things that impact that.
Yeah. Awesome. And you've got a couple of kids.
Got a couple of kids. They're both way gianter than me now, 14 and 17 year old boys, eating me out of house and home, and I love them madly.
Well, it's a good thing you do because they are going to take the toll financially, emotionally, psychologically. You know all of this. What made you, like, what lights you up about working with parents and kids and in this space of developing or helping kids grow in a healthy way to optimize them and, you know, performance and thinking and mental and emotional and physical health? What fascinates you about this?
Well, I guess there's a few things. One is that we know the early years last forever. And so how a child goes and grows, the environment around them forms their minds. And then they grow up and those minds are going to shape in turn the environment around them as adults, which really then does mean that kids are our future. And so there's something about that, I think, that drives me. And the other thing, when you work with kids, well, I actually don't work so much with kids. I'm mostly working with their grownups. But when you're working in the area of supporting kids, you get to see change in real time in a way that is kind of different from working solely with adult populations. And so I see kids who have been to hell and back, and they come out of that not just having survived it, but actually thriving in the face of it. And that's bananas to me.
I know with a lot of the things I'm going to ask you, there's no definitive answer, but if anyone's got a better idea than Tiff and I, it is definitely you. Some kids seem to, like, we've got a friend of ours who's on the show often. His name's Bobby Capuccio. He's kind of like my brother from another mother. He's from the States, but he grew up in New York, and he had, to put it mildly, he had a fucking horrible childhood, fucking horrible. But he's such an evolved human being, so aware, so compassionate, so intelligent, despite that horrible childhood. And not because any particular person guided him or was compassionate, but there were a couple of people, but you know how you always hear these stories of someone took me under my wing, under their wing, and he didn't really have that. But despite all of that, he's amazing. And then we hear stories, obviously and understandably, of other people who go through something similar, and it's pretty much the end of them. They capitulate. What are your thoughts around the context and contrast we see in that?
Well, I mean, you're right. There's no answer. But if I had to chew on that for a bit, I would think a few things. The first is I would think that, you know, we all come wired in our own unique ways. And I really do believe that some of us are just born under a different star, where we come out into the world and temperamentally we're just like ready to grab the bull by the horns and give her. And that is a unique temperament style, which I think if we look at people who've come through really formidable, challenging circumstances and risen above it, they often have that just like deep-seated drive, which I think they're probably born with. I also, you know, there's something about contractually, we each enter into our lives with sort of a path on board, and we live out that path. Not that it's pre-carved necessarily, but we're on a trajectory, and sometimes the contract that comes with that path is just a really big mother of a contract. And you know, it can be really defeating. And yet, you know, certainly when we look into the science of child development, we look in particular into the literature on resiliency, the number one variable that repeats time and time and time again is that there was one person, either for a prolonged period of time or in very salient moments, that really showed up for you.
I heard you on, by the way, folks, if I don't know what it's called, but it was 2016, you might remember, Vanessa, it was about a 26 minute talk you did to a group of mums. Anyway, it's on YouTube. It's an awesome presentation. If you want to see more of, well, you're not seeing Vanessa now, you're hearing her, but if you want to see Vanessa, go have a look at that after you listen to this. You were talking about the impact that environment has on developing brains, and you were talking about this, I don't know if it's a program or an organization where they train carers or foster parents to be essentially, you'll word it better than me, but awesome at nurturing and loving and caring for neglected kids who need that and who haven't had that. Tell us a little bit about I know the rest of this. Tell us a bit about that and how quickly their brains changed and that whole relationship between what's happening in the brain and love and kindness and nurturing and environment.
Yeah. So that was a very seminal study that was first published in Child Development in 2005, looking at the population of children in foster care ages 3 and 4 years old in the state of Oregon. Some of those kids were placed in special homes where the caregivers had been trained in the art of attachment or relationship-based caregiving, which really is about being compassionate to the developmental needs of children, not parenting through behaviorist methods, but parenting through that deep-seated connection as kind of the guiding light. And their measure of success, alongside many other things, was to look at cortisol response patterns. You can tap that in real time by taking a swab of saliva or plucking somebody's hair root and analyzing the root. And what they observed is that initially, upon measuring cortisol response to something surprising, they couldn't actually freak these kids out because that would be somewhat unethical. But the way that they stimulated a stress response in them was to produce these sort of unexpected puppets. And what they saw was that these kids' cortisol response patterns initially spiked very high and stayed high for quite a prolonged period of time before returning to higher than typical baseline patterns. Over time, what happened was the cortisol spike would go up, but not quite as high, and immediately settle back down. Two reasons that's significant. One, cortisol is toxic to the developing brain. The second reason is that in order to change the cortisol response pattern, you actually have to rewire a part of the brain called the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis. It's a little
bit. Wow, look at you. Look at you. Right. Elephant stamp, dude.
That's right. Next cocktail party, you can just like drop that one like it's hot. You have to rewire the HPA axis in order to change the response pattern. 3 months.
Wow.
And a changed HPA axis in the brain means as a grown-up, now you're going to be like light years ahead in terms of being able to manage stress. You're going to be buffered against all sorts of mental health issues, particularly the mood based disorders, anxiety and depression. Like it changes the entire trajectory of everything going forward. And it took 3 months to do it. So there's an investment that we make in the raising of our young and showing up for parents in a way that champions them to really understand how that all works is at the heart of eat, sleeping and breathing for me.
Isn't it amazing that there's a beautiful intersection between like literally amazing science and love?
Yeah.
Like compassion, kindness, nurturing has literal physiological benefits and can change, like literally change the physiology of a brain. You know, like how crazy, how fucking awesome is that? That we can, that kindness and love and compassion can, and not only their brain, but the, you know, like the endocrine system, the nervous system, well, which is part of the brain, you know, but like everything just with this one variable that's been introduced, which is, oh, let's put them in a loving environment with loving humans.
Imagine. You know, there's this guy, if you ever get the chance to interview him, he would be fascinating. His name is Bruce Perry. He's actually just published a book with Oprah Winfrey, but I knew him before he published a book with Oprah Winfrey.
Of course you did.
And he, so he's a trauma specialist, and he developed this intervention program called the Neurosequential Model of Therapeutics, which actually looks at how you can go backwards in time. So let's say, you know, a 16-year-old kid is rescued or apprehended out of a highly traumatic environment, and how you go backwards in time to the point of the initial trauma, even if they were 12 months old. And through love and caregiving approaches, you actually fill in the neuro gaps for simplicity that were missed out on because of the lack of love, the lack of caregiving. And when you can approach it that way, you rewire the brain through love. He said any other approach is a guilty salve for an indifferent public.
Oh, wow. He's... Boom, drops mic. Boom. Mm. Hey, one of the things I'm always talking to people about, my audiences, be it on the podcast or, you know, an actual live audience, is the way that we're programmed and, you know, like literally from when, and I have a specific question to you about this, but from when we could first understand anything, and until now, listening to this show, listening to this episode, we've been programmed and trained and taught and told and conditioned. And now here we are, a byproduct, largely a byproduct of that programming, that conditioning, those influences, situation, circumstance, environment, culture, all that stuff. And then trying to separate me, the me that exists beyond all of that, right? I'm getting deep, but I know you're with me. To separate all those influences from who I am beyond that, right? And to become aware of where Craig or Vanessa or Tiff or any of our audience, where I finish and my programming starts, right? Mm. So my long-winded question, one, I'd like you to speak to that, but my specific question is, at what age do we at kids really start to onboard information and process data and start to be programmed per se?
Oh, from the very beginning.
From
day one. And in fact, we might even suggest that that begins to happen in utero.
Yeah.
That the process of domestication begins before you've even arrived in the world, that you are receiving kind of, you know, there's a whole internal environment that you are marinating in and through epigenetics and other things, onboarding that information before you have been physically born. So it's certainly from the very beginning.
Mm. What do you, when, you know, they say that this definitely not my area, but by the time, what is it like by the time a child's, what's the number, five, that they're kind of, they've largely been programmed to what they're going to be like when they're 30, or is it seven, or what? Tell me those numbers and tell me how we optimize that and how we can maybe change that down the track for people who had a shit programming and a shit childhood and a shit journey, and then one day they're 30 and that's still who they are and how they are.
Yeah, the world is full of children walking around in grown-up bodies.
Perfect, perfect.
So, you know, there really isn't a magic number. Although when I was a doctoral student, I remember very clearly being told that things were mostly set by around age 12. Mm. Since then, the research and everything else has gone so much far beyond that. We know that neuroplasticity is alive and well across the lifespan, so that ship actually has never sailed. But as a basic rule of thumb, the older you are, the longer and steeper the climb will be. So when we're getting into really young brains, like the brains of those 3 and 4 year olds in that study that I was talking about, those are squishy, malleable, very open brains. We know that the infant brain, and not in terms of actual neurons, but in terms of neural connections. So anytime like a piece of a neuron touches another piece of a neuron, a little connection, and that they get looped up, the infant brain is forming about 1 million connections per second. So there is that makes that brain incredibly open to external influence, and it's positive as much as it's negative. So it can soak in real positive stuff, but it can also soak in real negative stuff. The youngest case of post-traumatic stress disorder that I've ever diagnosed was in a 4-month-old baby.
Wow.
And so even that very, very young brain really is at the effect of what's going on around. Generally speaking, the first 6 to 8 years are where the mind is being formed. And from there, we know that the brain doesn't fully mature until somewhere between age 25 and 30, a little earlier in that time span for females and a little later in that time span for males. So if we can make sure that kids have a pretty decent first, 6 to 8 years, we're probably sitting pretty solid in terms of having shored them up as far as resilience and other things go. In my work with adolescents, I do see that it's still very possible to have that turned around, and it does take a little bit longer. Once we see those kids emerge into adulthood, particularly by the time they've hit kind of the mid-20s, the transfer of responsibility for, and not even responsibility, but the pathway via which healing and evolvement will occur shifts. Because when kids are young, the responsibility for that shift is actually on their parents to recreate the environment so that the environment is transmitted up into the nervous system and into the hearts and souls of the child. And that's how we find our way through. In adulthood, you can no longer get it from the outside. You actually have to onboard it within self from the inside. And there's so much really interesting information around how we do that. But one of the things that I have come to know for sure, both within my own life and also in the lives of many of the parents who I support, is that it is never too late to have a good childhood.
Amazing. I love it. So in terms of, the environment that the child grows up in, of course, parents, love, the circumstances in which they're raised, all of that is obviously paramount and hugely influential. I want to chuck a couple of other variables at you and just talk about these. I was just writing as you were talking, what role, if any, they might play. So, and I'm talking about between, say, 0 and 8. So nutrition, sleep, movement, socialization, lifestyle, I guess, of the family, and education. Like, they'd all be influences as well. If you want to speak to any of those individually or collectively versus just the house that they grow up in and the family they grow up in.
Mm-hmm. So in terms of education, and closely related to that, this concept of socialization, particularly with a peer group, those pieces are the least important thing in the first 6 to 8 years. Education, insofar as it exists today, was not actually created initially with child development in mind. It was created with economics in mind. It was about how do we educate the masses in order to allow ourselves to be economically competitive on the world stage. So it really had nothing to do with children. And, you know, over time, of course, that system has evolved and we could say is much more, is much better now for kids. But there are some places in the world where there's very real conversations happening about delaying children's start in formal education until after the age of about 8 years. Because the other pieces that you've talked about are actually incredibly important as far as development of self and the brain. So movement is a big one. Movement outside in nature is even bigger. And movement outside in nature in the context of unstructured play is everything. Play that is risky, play that is full of imagination, play that is not adult driven, and most importantly, play that is disconnected from outcome. So there is no purpose to the play other than for play itself. We're not playing to learn our colors. We're not playing to learn how to count. We're not playing for any of these other things. We are playing because that's what we as human beings do in order to taste the world and be in the world and understand the world and onboard all sorts of rich indirect learning. That's what the first 6 to 8 years need to be about.
I love it. You know, I watched a thing the other night, a little doco. There's a show over here. I forget what it's called. It's one of the, it might be called Compass or it might be called, anyway, they do these like mini 30-minute documentaries. And I think it was called Is Finland the Happiest Place in the World or Why is Finland? So I think 4 years in a row, Finland's been, I don't know who votes on it, somebody. Anyway, they were talking about the, so in Finland, there's only about, if I remember the data, I think there's like 5 million-ish people. They don't start school until seven. And all schooling from primary, what we call primary, do you call it elementary? What do you call it in Canada?
We go back and forth between elementary and primary.
Yeah. So primary, secondary, you know, high school and university is all free. And another really interesting thing that I loved was in Finland, 90% of people who apply, you know, how, like, I'm sure it's similar in Canada, like to get into medicine here is like trying to get into the space program, right? It's, you know, it, you've got to, your score's got to be so high. You've got, you know, and same with a lot of careers. And sadly, for whatever reason, to get into teaching in Australia is the score is relatively low. The bar is pretty low, which shouldn't be that way. It is that way, but it shouldn't be that way because teachers obviously are crucially important, fascinating, awesome, special human beings. But in Finland, 90% of people who apply to get into teaching don't get in.
Wow.
There's only 1 in 10 who get in. And it's a highly, highly paid profession. And everyone who does teaching comes out with a master's. So that's the only, so an undergrad, you can't be a teacher. You come out with, I think it's 5 years, the actual teaching degree. So they do, I guess, their undergrad and master's all in one. But yeah, I was watching that with interest because it's such a contrast to the way that we do things in Australia. And there was such a, so little emphasis on, you know, building wealth and creating an empire. And not that those are bad things of themselves, but there was such a focus on connection and happiness and socialization and family. And I thought, yeah, you know, it's not that it one model is the right model, but it was certainly an interesting insight for me.
Yeah, it's a real different alignment of values in that kind of a system.
Yeah.
It also makes me think, I was supervising a dissertation a few years ago, and it was on nature school, outdoor education. And I remember Finland was actually very high on the list in terms of the number of outdoor education schools that exist, which again, there's a, you can almost feel the pendulum swing that's happening there in terms of what is important and what we put our resources and our time and our minds towards. And kids really do come out ahead in those kinds of settings.
Tell me about the balance between loving and nurturing our kids, Doc. and being awesome parents? Where's the line before we start to become toxic, overbearing, you know, parents that want to nerf the world and protect them, and we don't want them to fall over, and we don't want them to, you know, to lose a race. Oh my God, he lost. Quick, give him, you know, give him McDonald's, or I don't know. Like, at what point do we go, he or she needs to fall over and come last sometimes and fail an exam and then not be picked up and cuddled?
Yeah. You know, that's what I refer to as the seedy underbelly of relationship-based parenting. And I research in that field. I live that as a parent myself, and I certainly coach and support parents along that path. But what I have witnessed is that there becomes this tipping point where all of a sudden it's no longer actually working for the child, where we get into this, you know, they're being very kind of buffered and mollycoddled, and they never have an opportunity to actually figure out what courage is, or to actually figure out that they can do hard things, or that they can fail at something and be okay on the other side of it. So the way that I often talk about that with my parent families is I invite them to pay attention to the intention. If the intention that you have in terms of stepping into that moment and offering the cuddle and there, and no, and I'll just do it for you and all of those kinds of things, if the intention comes out of a place of discomfort from within yourself, then you are actually acting in that moment in the service of your own unmet needs rather than in the service of your child's needs. And so that's when relationship-based caregiving switches over and becomes helicopter parenting.
Yes.
Usually born of the parent's own angstiness or unmet or unresolved needs.
Yeah, it's so interesting. And I mean, of course we want to love and protect our kids, of course, but I think there's a line where it goes from being, you know, positive to maybe negative. And it, nobody wants to see our kid hurt, of course, or in pain or in suffering, or but the reality is, you know, in a minute that kid's not going to be a kid, right? That kid's going to be a grown-up, and the world's not fair, and the world gives no fucks about your kid, and people are nasty, and bad shit happens to good people. And I want my kids to have skill and awareness and strength and resilience and courage and insight and experience dealing with hard shit. Now, if they never deal with, if I get too technical for you, Doc, let me know, because I can, you know, at times it's just a thing I have because I'm hugely academic, as you can see. But if we raise them in this bubble that's there is no adversity, we think we're kind of empowering them, but I think we're disempowering them.
Yeah, and you disable by enabling, right? When you're swooping in all the time.
Ooh,
and
I love
that. The trick, of course, is that we don't want to have them so flooded with overwhelm and challenge that the ship begins to sink. So you're always needing to navigate. Yeah. And sometimes I say to parents, you just got to sniff the air around your kid and figure out, is this a time to step in or is this a time to step back? And in terms of this, you know, self-regulation, the ability to hang on to our big feelings, to grow up into adults who can manage challenge, all of that kind of stuff, you got to practice.
Yeah.
And you want them practicing when they have the soft landing of your care, your home, your relationship, to kind of buffer them against the ills of all of that. If they don't get to practice and we release them out into the world as adults and they don't have that onboarded yet, there is going to be trouble.
How do we as parents, like the way I said that, Tiff? I'm not a parent, which probably shines through. Which is, for the children of the world, that is a good thing, because I'd be a shit dad.
But you were once a child.
Oh, that's right. So oh, no, not once. Not once, Doc.
I can just see the little boy in you coming out to play.
I'm a child in a grown-up's body, and that is, it's so hard for me to stay on track because I always have such ridiculous thoughts. In Australia, we would say I'm like a dog with three dicks, but I'd never say that to you because that's inappropriate and I don't want you to get offended, right?
So we analyze that, I think.
Yeah. You can, don't think about that too much. I don't even know what I was going to say to you now. Oh, yeah. So red herring. So have you heard of a guy called Gary Chapman? Probably more importantly, I'm sure you have because of what you do, a book called The Five Love Languages.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you think of that? Are you familiar with it or you've just heard of it?
I'm familiar with it.
So the idea, you correct me if I fuck anything up.
Okay.
But so the idea, folks, is that everyone has a kind of different love language and some people respond to, there's five different ones. Acts of service, quality time, gifts, physical touch, and words of affirmation, right? Now, because I'm hugely insecure and needy, words of affirmation, probably mine, right? Lot of issues. So, what we do sometimes, his kind of assertion is that we love people the way that we want to be loved, but that doesn't necessarily work for them, which I think is a sound kind of hypothesis. And ready, set, go.
So all human beings for all of history and all of future want but one thing. And that one thing is the experience of being seen and heard. So that we are understanding from that person's point of view what their experience is of any given moment. Which means that the way we enter into relationship with that person will be directly responsive to what it is that we are picking up in terms of what they're putting down. When we love from an internal perspective only, there is no space for seeing and hearing the other. When we love from a relationship-based space, then the entire direction is to see and hear the other. And that's very true in parenting. And so my two boys are cut from the same cloth, but could not be more different from one another. The way that I managed things for my older son, who's what I call a dandelion child, was entirely different from how I managed things for my younger son, who's what I call an orchid child, where I really had to be responding to the internal workings of each of them as individuals rather than how I do parenting. And it also is true of all of our other kinds of relationships. The bottom line is that if you think that there is, you know, a one size fits all trick or strategy in terms of how you parent or do relationship, you've been sold a line. Because it does not how it's going to work.
Yeah, I think that's true for pretty much everything, isn't it? But sadly, we live in curiously, we live in a culture where often we think there's a three-step plan or a one-step plan to weight loss or business success or relationship happiness or inner peace or fulfillment. And I think it's a very individual and personal work. So two things. One, just if you want to expand on the orchid and the dandelion, that's question one. And two is the Disneyland story. Yes, I heard it. And I don't want to spoil it.
Is it the throwing up Disneyland story?
Yeah, that one.
So
Disneyland's not the happiest place in the world for everyone or whatever. Yeah.
The orchid and the dandelion. This is actually out of the work of a man named Thomas Boyce, who very luckily for me was on sabbatical at the university where I was doing my doctoral degree back in the late 90s, early 2000s. And the orchid and the dandelion comes out of, crazy mind-blowing research on how we are wired so differently as human beings and how that translates into how we present temperamentally and otherwise. He has since published a book called The Orchid and the Dandelion, Why Some Children Struggle and How All Can Thrive. If you're a parent, if you're somebody that works with children, or if you've ever been a child, you probably should read that book.
I think that covers, hang on, Yep, that's that covers everyone. Yep, okay. Hang on, I was just checking. I was doing the maths. Yep.
So if you've ever tried to grow a dandelion, you will know that you can plant them in a crack in the cement sidewalk and forget to water them, and they will flourish. That's my firstborn son. He got born. He's pretty happy about it. He ate and he slept. He went to school. He made friends. He played sports. He used to compete in chess.
Wow.
And he was like fierce about it. Like he's, and to this day, 17 years old, he's got a full-time job lifeguarding down at the beach and coaching sailing all summer. And he just kind of does it all. Like he just, you know, it just all happens for him. And then along comes his little brother 3.5 years later, who is an orchid. And if you've ever tried to grow an orchid, you will know that they need just the right amount of water and just the right amount of light and just the right humidity and just the right everything or they die. So here this kid gets born, and I don't know if you know, but I'm a child psychologist. I'm supposed to know everything there is to know about growing kids up in the best possible way.
Well, you better. That's why we got you on.
So much pressure. This kid is born. He comes out crying and doesn't fucking stop. And I think to myself, but I'm Dr. Vanessa LaPointe. Like, what is happening, right? It took me 8 weeks to realize that the sound of my singing voice, and while it is true that I do not have the voice of an angel, it is not that horrible, but the sound of my singing voice is making my kid cry. And here I've got this sobbing baby, and I'm singing to him to try to calm him, and I'm actually making him cry more. And it went on from there. And, you know, he's 14 years old now, and he is, I mean, every single one of my perfectly colored gray hairs is because of how humbled I have been in my role as a mother to figure it out. How do I shift it so that he's shielded enough, but not too much? How do I shift it so that his needs are being met when I can't figure out what the need is, right? He had to go on medical leave at the end of first grade because he started throwing up every day. He was so stressed out at school.
Wow.
And the acid from his vomit ate through his esophagus.
Wow.
And I'm a child psychologist. And now I got a kid getting diagnosed with an anxiety disorder. And I'm thinking, I don't know what I've done wrong, right? Fast forward to present day with a lot of, you know, thinking it through and reading everything I could get my hands on and really figuring it out. It's not been a straight path, but he's blooming like the orchid blooms. If you can stick with the orchid, the bloom's going to be stunning. And that kid is the most, this is actually funny because of how I used to make him cry by singing, the most talented musician you can imagine. He plays his guitar 14, 15 hours a day. He's got instructors lined up down the street just wanting the chance to work with him. He's magic. He's just alive and quirky and interesting and fantastic. And the path was so different from the brother. And so that's the orchid and the dandelion. I happen to have two on very opposite ends of the continuum, but you can have kids kind of wandering up and down anywhere along the way.
I love that. All right, tell us about Disneyland.
So we take the orchid and the dandelion to Disneyland. You know, the happiest place on earth. And this orchid kid, in the insanity of what is Disneyland, where it's like a zillion people and it's loud and it smells and it's fun and it's crazy and it's overwhelming. And so, of course, my 5-year-old orchid son, he's 5 at the time, he really believed Buzz Lightyear was real, which was awesome. But he gets a migraine. And the kind of migraine where you're going to throw up. And it's the end of the night. He's like fevered through the fireworks show, you know, and we're leaving the park at the end of the night. And you have to kind of line up to get through security to get out of the park and get back to the hotel. And as we're in that lineup, he throws up, like messy, barfy throwing up all over. Immediately, security calls a code V, V for vomit. And it's like, these little like cleaner people come up out of the ground and they have like this sucker upper machine. So they're sucking up the vomit and they spray down some water and then they suck it all up and then they drop down under the ground again. Like they literally materialized out of nowhere and the vomit's all gone. We get back to the hotel room. He's sick the rest of the night. And the next day, I stay in the hotel. And he's messy sick. Like, there is throwing up. That hotel room became a biohazard zone. The next day, he and I, of course, stay in the room all day while his brother and dad go out to enjoy the park again. And then I think the next day, it was time for us to go home. And we were sitting on the airplane. And the goal always, when you're a child psychologist who's also raising children, which I will tell you is an occupational hazard, is to find your children developing what we call mixed feelings, where they can see two things at the same time within the mind's eye. Because when you can develop mixed feelings, now we're off to the races in terms of being able to have empathy, being able to have delayed gratification, you know, like so many other things. Mm. So we're sitting on the airplane to come home and he's sitting beside me and his face is all, you know, like dark circles under his eyes. He's been throwing up for 2 days. And he says to me, "Mom, I'm really sad to be going home from Disneyland. And I'm really happy to be going home from Disneyland." And
oh, wow.
We made it. Mixed feelings, onboarded, thanks to the debacle that is the happiest place on earth. And that also is the intensity of the orchid child when it comes to, you know, navigating the world that we live in. It is intense for them.
I love that. I love that analogy. I love that metaphor. I love that story because, you know, that what you just shared then, that last 10 minutes, that's so many people right now are going, I get it, because they've got a dandelion or an orchid or you know, somewhere on that scale, you know, and it's so relatable and so real. And it's funny, you know, it's interesting, isn't it, how not just with kids, but with grown-ups too, like being in a certain situation will be for some people almost unbearable in terms of anxiety and fear and, you know, all the stuff that comes with that. But another person will be in the exact same place. And not only do they have none of that, they're actually having a great time, which is, you know, tells us how much we, the individual, create our experience. Like my experience, my literal personal experience is all about how I consciously or not create that based on what I think is going on or the story I'm telling myself, whether I'm a kid or a grown-up. Because when I tell myself a story and I believe the story, now I'm in the fucking story. It doesn't actually matter what the external objective reality is. It just matters what I believe in that moment, right?
My thoughts create my reality, right? And Viktor Frankl said, between stimulus and response, there is a space.
Yeah.
And that space is your freedom. It's your power to choose. We, you know, I have been known to sit in my office and ask people to tell me that they like my shoes. Mm. And then I say to them, you just made it up. I mean, thanks, but it's a story. Mm. You could have just easily said, I don't like your shoes. Either way, you're right. Mm. There's a very loud train that rolls by my house during the night. Mm. And I have a story about that train that makes the sound of that train whistle divine to me.
Mm.
I could just as easily be like, are you effing kidding me? Mm. We don't have whistle cessation on the train yet. Mm. What the heck?
Mm.
Right? Mm. I could say that. Or because I grew up in the Canadian prairies where the CN Railway passed about 500 meters from my house. And that sound to me is like being ensconced in my childhood bed, drifting off to, I love it. Mm. So that's my story. It's divine.
That's so smart, isn't it? What were you like as a kid?
Well, I have three sisters. They're all very prim and proper and sorted out. I am definitely the black sheep, wild child of the family. My dad says I came out of the delivery room and smiled at everybody that would look at me and kind of never stopped. I was a competitive athlete growing up. I was a figure skater for many years. And so really feel like a lot of how I tick now connects back to some of the incredibly formative experiences that came my way as part of being in that world. And I've always had this kind of, I always joke, I don't know if you know the concept of counter will, which is our instinct to do the opposite of what somebody has asked of us. And we all have it on board. But I've always kind of joked, I don't have counter will, I have counter won't. By which I mean, like, you, like, you're going to tell me that's hard? Watch me.
Yeah. Is that, what's that about?
I'm not really sure. You know, I grew up, my family didn't have a lot of money or other things, and it was unheard of that somebody in my family would go to graduate school or do any of those kinds of things. And I just kind of remember thinking, from the time I was knee high to a grasshopper, which is a prairie thing, I just remember thinking, well, why not? And, you know, I am a curious mix of orchid and dandelion. I'm an incredibly intense and sensitive human being, but I also have this sort of je ne sais quoi ability to grind out the tricky moments in life and persevere.
Yeah.
I think probably it was that I had a mom and a dad who, you know, even though they struggled in different ways, really believed in me.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure they were good parents, and I'm sure you and your three sisters mostly get on.
Yeah, that's right.
Isn't it funny how, you know, siblings, same parents, same environment, same, you know, a couple of variables, but for the most part, almost the fucking same, can be so, so different. How do we as parents, and this is a whole podcast in itself, I know, but if you could give us a minute or two on it, how do we, I guess it's a two-part question, how do we not pass on our own bullshit to our kids? Because all of us, including you and me and Tiff and everyone listening, I've still got bullshit and I'm 150 years old, right? I'm still working through my own crap. So how do we not pass on our issues and our self-limiting beliefs and all of that stuff that is part of the human experience? How do we not hand that down to our kids?
Do your own work. So you have to grow yourself in order to be able to grow children. And as a group, parents are actually the least happy group of people out there. But we also know that parents feel very fulfilled and purposeful in their life. And certainly it's been true for me personally, and insofar as I've witnessed it in thousands of families now in my career, when we have children, it will drop you to your knees. It is meant to do that. The process of figuring out how to grow another human with love as your guide is not for the faint of heart. And so if we don't want to pass that on to our children, we are called to make sure that we are doing our own work, that we have turned the spotlight inside, that we are going to be able to take responsibility for the idea that our kids can't make us feel anything. Your kid didn't make you mad. You made you mad. Your kid didn't make you yell. You made you yell. Figure out where that's coming from. Your kid doesn't make you overwhelmed. You make you overwhelmed. That feeling of overwhelm is something that's probably followed you forward from your own childhood, because we will parent as we were parented, unless we go inside and we do the work required to address our oftentimes relationship-based childhood wounds and recreate a childhood for ourselves.
Yeah.
It's never too late to have a good childhood, so that we can gift to our children the experience of growing up and having the kind of childhood that they themselves don't have to recover from. I want to read you a quote.
Yeah.
By a guy named, I think, Terry Riel. Family dysfunction rolls down from generation to generation like a fire in the woods, taking down everything in its path until one person in one generation has the courage to turn and face the flames.
Wow.
When you do that, that person brings peace to the ancestors and spares the children that follow.
Wow, that is incredibly well written, but also such a powerful idea and such a power. Well, it's not even an idea. It's a truth, isn't it?
Yeah.
Wow, that's amazing. That's amazing. Yeah, I could talk to you for a very long time. One of the things that occurred to me, you know, I'm an only kid, which explains a lot, but not a spoiled only kid though, just an only kid, grew up in the country, but great mum and dad. But my mum and dad were not, they were great. It was, my childhood was like, I lived with two adults who were ace. We all got on great. But it wasn't like, I now know, it wasn't like the typical nurturing, warm family. It wasn't cold, but my mum, when my mum was born, her mum died on giving birth to her, right? So my mum never had a mum, and my dad grew up, I won't expand on it, but in a shit environment, and first year of the Second World War, he was born in the Great Depression, six boys, like eight people, one income, lots of terrible issues. But it's funny, as I got older, like as I was growing up, I, because I'm gregarious and I love people and I love helping and sharing and hugging and connection, and my mum and dad are a bit like that, but in a lot of ways a little bit emotionally what's the word, you know, like unavailable-ish, although they're changing as they get older. But I remember having all these expectations of how my dad should be towards me and how my mum should be towards me. Because by the time I was 30, I thought I was pretty clever and I'm understanding this whole human thing. And my father really needs to do more of this. And he, you know, he's not a good father in this and that. And my mother, and right? Because I was the fucking golden head boy and I knew everything. But it was only when I got over my own bullshit, all my story was bullshit, by the way. It was 98% me that was the issue. And I started to go deep into their story and their childhood and their upbringing and what they both didn't have. And then I compared it to my childhood, which was like a fucking Disney movie compared to their childhood, right? And I realized that I had expectations of them that were ridiculous based on their story and their journey. And also based on their story and their journey, they were actually mum and dad of the century.
Yeah.
You know, so I think when we understand the person's story, we understand the person better, you know, because we all look at certain behavior, you know, we look at what other people do or don't do. And then we look at that through the window of our expectations and understanding and standards, and then we judge them, their stuff, based on our stuff. And so often that's where the problem lies. And when I reframed it, literally not just to make myself feel better, but to actually go, stop being so self-focused and self-centered and understand them. And I think if I went through what they went through, I don't think I would have been as good as they are. You know, and I think as we, like, you're a kid, you're still a kid, you're someone's kid, I'm still someone's kid, you know, like we all, it's perpetual, this being a kid thing.
Yeah. And even within each of us, we are all the ages that we have ever been. So I'm still my parents' kid, but then inside of me, there's like a one-year-old version of me and a two-year-old version of me and a three-year-old version of me and a 16-year-old version of me and a 22, she was awesome, 22-year-old version of me. Like, they're all still inside of me.
Yeah.
And so they kind of bubble up sometimes in the course of interactions and relationships and other kinds of things.
Yeah. Now, we know you've got to go. So here's my red herring question. What's going on in Canada with COVID right now? How are you all? What's the update? What's the status?
Well, we've been to the bottom of it and we're on our way back up. So it was very touch and go for us for quite a long while. Up until about 2-3 weeks ago, we were still under pretty significant restrictions, at least here in British Columbia. Because we've seen a pretty significant drop in our numbers, provincially we were seeing about 1,100 cases a day as of a couple months ago. And now we're down to less than 200, even trending towards about 100 new cases a day, which are really great numbers for us. Mm. So we're feeling optimistic. We're feeling like it's trending in the right direction. Mm. And what's so fascinating to me as somebody in the mental health world is how freaked out everybody is about the fact that it's almost over now. We were freaked out because it was happening, and now we're freaked out because it's almost over. So
it's been an interesting byproduct, hasn't it? There are lots of people now in Australia too who don't want to go back to work, or they don't want to go back to work the way that they did work. Mm-hmm. So there's been a real shift. And I mean, I'm sure you're the same, but you know, a year and a half ago, I'm like, I'm not doing a presentation online. I'm not talking to a computer.
It's not real enough.
And last week I did a gig to nearly 1,000 people in 38 countries.
Wow.
I'm like, how awesome is this? Like, right? this is not an adequate replacement. This is better. You know, of course live rooms are great, but how can you talk to people in 38 countries if you don't do it this way? You know, well, wow, you're amazing. So tell us about all your stuff. How can people get your book, connect with you, follow you, come and stalk you, knock on your front door? How can they do all of that?
DrVanessaLapointe.com, DrVanessaLapointe.com is where I hang out. Of course, I'm on Instagram and Facebook. My books are Discipline Without Damage, which is all about how to discipline without messing your kids up. And my latest book is Parenting Right from the Start, or Parenting Right from the Start, depending on the story that you use to interpret the title, which is all about how we become who we become and making sense of those first formative years of our lives. And so come and hang out.
Awesome. Thank you so much. So if you stay on the call for one sec. Thanks, Doc. Thanks, Tiff.
Thanks, Harps. Thanks, Vanessa.
Thank you both very much.
Thanks, everyone. Love you guts. See you next time.